Accession number 6912, Reel 3.
Mr. Thorne, Reel 3.
Well, Corporal Lisa refused to leave me, and I had the sense, although I couldn't move, to consolidate as had been taught to every British officer that the most dangerous time at the conclusion of an attack is to wait for the counterattack to come in, and the I got my platoon sorted out as far as I could, because we had two more Africans I think were wounded by the same bullet that I was, but I don't know that. But anyhow, I was down to one rifleman then, and with the Lewis guns I got sorted out so that they were ready to repel a counterattack. By that time B Company had started crossing the river. They were on the one of the companies who were ordered to stay on that side, and they'd started crossing the river by the Brown Bridge. They put some planks across it and got chaps and stretcher bearers as well. And I don't know whether you know that Africans look after their white ranks very well, and they don't look after one another. It's their custom. The stretcher bearers came up and put me on a stretcher, and I said, where are the other two Africans? Oh, well, they'll be all right. I said, look, take me off this stretcher and see, I want to see these two Africans on stretchers before you put me on, and that's an order. I hadn't lost consciousness or anything like that, because I knew they might be left. It may sound frightfully gallant, but it was done from a sensible point of view to get them out. You see, if they went in front of me, I knew they were all right. Anyhow, we got, Corporal Issa wouldn't leave me, and we got to the ditch of the side of this road, and we heard tanks coming down the road. And Blackton, who ought to have got a DSO, if anybody deserved a decoration, he did, was standing in the middle of the road with a fly whisk in his hand, no equipment, and ordering people about the place and saying, and he turned to me and said, well, sorry, old Rosie, to see that you've been bashed, we'll get you out in a minute, and so on, and not taking any notice of any dirt that was flying about, all these tanks coming down the road, the Italian counterattack coming in with tanks and catching us very disorganised on the wrong side of the river, on the enemy side of the river. And that is where Sergeant Leakey did his stuff. He'd fired off all his mortar bombs and he joined A Company. I saw him flitting past me and I don't know what happened to him, and we didn't know for some time afterwards that he opened the first tank's turret, shot the commander, tried to get in, couldn't, leapt off that one and shot the next one, went on to the third one, and was never seen again. As you know, he got a posthumous VC for that. He was the one of the two East African VCs. Colonel Wilson was the other one. He's still alive, actually. I met him the other day. And, of course, as a result of that, I mean, a tank coming down the road and these narrow roads, I mean, it had gone over me, and that would have been that. I can quite definitely say he saved my life. After that, must have been in a very high state of tension, because that's my temperament in any event. They started to evacuate the wounded. And my two Africans had been wounded. They went across this very narrow planks of this bridge. They went across. They were using two Africans and two prisoners of war, you see. Going over, they very nearly dipped me in, which, looking back on it, was quite amusing. And all these African Italian prisoners were sitting on the side of the road, and I saw one or two people thinking, oh, we got one of the British officers. And I thought, we're not having that. I still got my 3-8 with me, so I made them all stand up as I passed. I said, you talk. They didn't understand what I was talking about at all. I didn't speak in Italian. Must have been fairly far gone by that time. I said, stand up while a British officer passes. And they did. And they got us up to the regimental aid post, and then the South Africans bombed us. And Fuchs sent a message back to the South African Air Force commander by saying, thank you very much for your support. You have doubled my casualties. Considering, I think we took about 600 prisoners all told in a very strong defensive position. And I think our casualties were one white rank killed, that was Sergeant Leakey, three white ranks, which I was one of them, wounded, 17 Africans killed. I can't remember the number of Africans killed, but only about 17 casualties in all, mostly in A Company, because Ted Onslow was very upset about it. He'd lost a subaltern, and he'd lost a lot of his Africans, and he's a very fine, absolutely first-class chap. Well, as a result of that, Fuchs, who was right up with the battalion headquarters, he was watching the battle, which is where a commander should be, and not sitting back on his arse in the base somewhere. He turned to Blackton and said, you can have as many decorations as you want. And Lucy Field very decently said, well, I don't know who gets one, but Thorne must get one. Now, that does not show any sign of bravery on anything, but it does mean that the leading platoon commander in any battle or anything, if he doesn't get killed, he very often gets a military cross, and he's not a brave man. A person like Ted Onslow, who got every time he went into action was put up for a military cross, he was a really brave man. And these chaps that you see in the, you know, the obituaries in the paper of two DSOs and an MC and so on, that's a brave man. Cunningham, the commander, he only died the other day. He'd had a tremendous 14-18 war record. I could forget what his actual decorations were, but certainly DSOs and MCs, I don't know. But one MC, don't take any notice of it, you're just the leading platoon commander. I'm very proud to have it. But it doesn't signify, it merely signifies you've done your job. It doesn't signify bravery to my mind. Perhaps I'm wrong. Then we took a long time to get back to Addis, where the American Mission Hospital, which was supposed to be a casualty clearing station with a base hospital in Nairobi, but it was used as a base hospital. It was absolutely full of wounded. The South Africans were coming up on the other side of Abyssinia, and the Gold Coast Brigade, and all of them converging on Addis Ababa from a casualty point of view. And so the place was, the RAMC, it wasn't their fault, the evacuation was so bad. We had these ghastly ambulances, and many an African died as a result of not having attention. And there was a bit of a tendency amongst the RAMC to say, are there any white ranks here to look after the white ranks? And I wouldn't have it. I was in an ambulance with three Africans, one of whom died, got the whole of his back blown out. It was dreadful. And anyhow, we got back to the American Mission Hospital, and I was put in a ward with a lot of South Africans, and they wouldn't speak to me. And I thought, this is damn funny, the South Africans are not like that, they're good blokes. And I couldn't walk, and they were Italian orderlies, and of course you had to relieve yourself and you wanted a bedpan and so on and so forth. And I cursed this chap, I couldn't speak Italian, and cursed him in English and said, for God's sake, get me a bedpan, as I'll bloody well bash you, or something like that. And the whole ward started roaring with laughter. I said, well, what's funny about that? They said, we thought you were an Italian, because I'd forgotten I'd got I don't know, a fortnight's beard on me or some long time, and was very dark haired and could look like an Italian, short and one thing and another. And they, of course, then they were very matey and so on and so forth. And I chanced it and managed to drag my leg along to the lavatory the next day. I think I couldn't stand this. And the doctor came round after about 2 days and he said, "Thorne, I think you can get up." So I said, "Thank you very much, doctor, having been up for 2 days." And then we got, they got us back, they started moving casualties back to Nairobi, and we came back through Hargeisa to Berbera in these South African iron lorries. They were all iron, not made of wood at all, and they were fantastically hot. And where I was in Diridaya Hospital, and we got a lot of these people with belt sores, you know, kind of scratches that go septic. And I thought, I'm bound to go septic with an open wound in my hip and so on and so forth. And got to Hargeisa and I healed up, and the doctors wouldn't believe it. I've always had very good healing blood. And we got to Berbera, and there was a lovely hospital ship waiting. And we all went aboard, and we went light-headed, because white sheets and you know, pleasant nurses, and they said, "Would you like a drink?" We said, "Yes, what have you got?" And they said, "Whiskey." We said, "Whiskey?" So they gave us whiskey, a tiny little tot of whiskey all round, and we had a perfectly pleasant voyage down in this hospital ship to Mombasa. And by that time I was getting a lot fitter. I was very lame, but I'd healed up. And we got to Mombasa, and in the train to Nairobi I was picked up by ambulances there and put in Lady Macmillan's convalescent home, which was a convalescent home for Africans. And I had a whale of a time there, because all my brother officers' wives lived in Nairobi, and of course they were all frightfully keen to hear about their husbands and so on, and what we'd done and so on. And rumours have been trickling back that the first six had put up a show, because we got, if it's any indication, we got 11 decorations, which wasn't bad for an African battalion. We got one VC with Leakey, four MCs, one white MM, that was to a chap named West, who was killed in Madagascar afterwards, and five black MMs. Ted Onslow got an MC, Lucy Field, the second in command, got an MC, Roger Swinnerton got an MC, and I got an MC. That was two company commanders, the second in command, and one platoon commander. And, West was commanding a platoon, although he was a sergeant. And that was the peak of the first six efficiency. They really were the crack battalion, the KR, at that time. The fifth were good, but not quite as good as we were. And then we started to go downhill after that, as so often happens.
How long were you convalescing for at Mombasa?
Well, I wasn't convalescing in Mombasa. We went up to Lady Macmillan's convalescent home in Nairobi. And I think I mentioned that my brother officers' wives all lived in Nairobi, and they were very interested to hear what was what had gone on and so forth. And then, to their very great pleasure, and the pleasure of the other people in the convalescent home, my military cross came through. It was an immediate award, and there's a bit of celebration, as you can imagine. And I had a whale of a time in Nairobi and used up all my money. So, and they said, "Right, now you're fit again, you can go to the transit camp and in Nairobi." And there was a chap named Nugent, who's one of the Nugent family, who was a 1418 war soldier, and he was in the RASC. He wasn't, you know, he was too old to be an infantry officer. He was taking a convoy up to Addis Ababa. And I said, "I'm not going to any transit camp. Can you give me a lift up to Addis?" So he said, "Yes, do you draw 7 days' rations? Do you speak Swahili?" I said, "Yes, well, I do a bit. I'm not very good." He said, "That's fine." And the rains were on. And the rains are not funny when you do get them, because everything turns to mud. And he was taking a couple of tractors up. He said, I can only give you a lift as far as Addis. Anyhow, we had a journey through the bush, which was uneventful, but he was a man of very great grip. We went up to Mogadishu and then on to Addis through the way that we'd already advanced before. And I found out in Addis that the first six were at Desie, which is in the north. And so I hitched a lift from Addis to Desie, and it's rather amusing. I turned up in the battalion headquarters and reported in the proper manner, and Colonel Blackton said, Rosie, with a pun on my name and my face, I get very red in the face, we haven't been notified that you were coming back to us. Very glad to see you, but we haven't had anything through from headquarters on that. I thought, I'll bet you haven't, because I've deserted, technically. Deserted forward, you see. He said, I said, well, can I go back to A Company? He said, no, I want you to go to D. So you do what you're told. He said, we're just preparing for Gonder. Well, D Company wasn't anything like as good as A Company, and I was a bit sad about that. And while I was in Nairobi, it was rather... thing that I've always been pleased about the Red Cross, I went to them and I said, look, I'm in the first 6 KR, can you let me have some comforts for the troops? They said, yes, what would you like? I said, I'd like 2 crates of bottled beer. And they gave them to me, and they weren't crates of a dozen bottles, they were about 48 bottles in the in each crate, and I was able to give one to my old company, A Company, and one to D Company, because you were always expected, if you did come back, to bring something back with you, because they were on, well, not very good rations and so on and so forth, and I was very popular as a result of that. Well, then we started off for we had a bit of trouble in Dessier, because as I said earlier, the Abyssinians are absolutely full of VD, and of course the Africans had the same tastes as anybody else has, and they were getting VD right and left, and of course it was cutting our strength down. So they set up brothels, properly organised brothels, and of course the VD dropped straight away, until they heard of it in Nairobi and they said, you can't have any brothels, and of course the VD went up again. Anyhow, we managed to press on. And we had the most hair-raising experience to get to attack Gonder, because the country is fantastically mountainous. There's no great peaks, but it's a plateau of about 12,000 feet. And we were in tropical kit, and it was damn cold at night. And of course, the lorries didn't like it a bit. You know, they weren't organised for that, because of the thinness of the air or something that I didn't understand. And to get to this place, Fuchs was still our brigadier, and he decided to do a flanking movement, or somebody had decided to do a flanking movement, not go direct. And I remember seeing the thing that is marked on this map. One of these little Portuguese forts, which was set up in the 14th or 15th century, and which shows what a lot of guts the Portuguese had, because it was fantastically wild country. And they weren't much more than towers, but they got penetrated right into the depths of Abyssinia as long ago as, well, I don't know the actual date, but Gonder Castle was the same. That was a Portuguese castle. And as I say, it must have been built about... the 14th century, I should say, as was the castle in Mombasa. That's a Portuguese castle as well. Anyhow, we had the most hair-raising experience driving lorries along knife edges with a drop of 3,000 feet on one side and 5,000 feet on the other. And I think I was more scared of that than I was in fighting the Italians. Anyhow, we eventually got to where we're kind of forming up place, and the first six had A Company detached from it. We were very... We'd lost Blackton, who had moved up to brigadier, and I think folks had moved up to divisional commander. Godwin Austin, who was the divisional commander, had moved somewhere else. But as a second lieutenant, I really don't know that. We got our second in command moved up to CO, and he was absolutely useless. He's dead now. And he was so bad that three subalterns, one of whom is now a major general, and I'm not mentioning his name, he may be on your list actually, and another subaltern whose name I've forgotten, said, when we get into action, we'll shoot him. And I said, yes, well, do remember that when you shoot him, you get him to turn around and shoot him in the front. Don't shoot him in the back. Because he was so useless. And my father had told me, we talked about 1418 war, he said, if you see anybody running, it's your job as an officer to stop them. He said, the only way to stop them is to shoot them. So I'd remembered what the old man had said. And so we made this pact that on this first attack at Kirkabar, we would... No, I'm sorry. On the second attack on Kirkabar, we made this pact after that. I'm sorry about that. My memory is bad. But on the first attack at Kirkabar, we did a three-day approach march with very little rations and very little water. And discipline was going to hell. And mostly night marches. And we were really jaded by the time we got there. And the discipline was beginning to break because we got this useless man as CO. And I remember we didn't know quite where we were. Kirkabard's a pretty high, not a mountain, but a hill. I remember coming up with my sergeant major, coming on some British ranks who were sitting round, sergeants and so on, sitting round smoking. And as I say, discipline was going. And I remember coming up to him and said, what are you lot sitting around here? And they said, well, we don't know where to go and so on. And I said, well, put your cigarettes out and get marching and come with me. And I thought they were going to shoot me. Because, as I say, I couldn't care a damn for anybody at that time. I've nothing to lose. You've got one pip to lose. You couldn't care less about it. They could see I meant it. Because there was no doubt about it if there was going to be any shooting done, who was going to do it first. And that was me. Now, it sounds like a hell of a line, that, but somebody's got to show some grip. And if you're the senior bloke there, you're the chap to show it. And anyhow, that they got into some kind of order, and we then did the approach march by night to Kirkabar. And there was it was a very steep hill. How the chaps got their mortars up, I don't know. The Africans got their mortars up with a pretty heavy load, you know, the base plate and so on. We'd got Brens by that time. We weren't any better. We hadn't got any more men. And I was in D Company, which I didn't pick very much. And anyhow, the acting CO gave out his orders. We got up this ridge. And I said to my company commander, I was still a second lieutenant, but I was acting second commander of the company because there wasn't anybody else. I said to him, for God's sake, do something about this. Get these chaps into some kind of formation. He'd never been in action before, although he's a regular soldier, and I was looked upon an experienced bloke by that time. I said, they'll open up on us as soon as they find we're here. And he said, what do you advise? I said, get them spread out and get down. More or less, as soon as I'd said it, they opened up on us. And I went flat on my face. And, of course, so did the Africans. The Africans were damn sight better than he was, actually. And I got in front of one of our own brain guns. I thought I was lying flat on the ground. He was firing over the top of me, which wasn't very jolly fun. And firing stopped a bit. There's very often a break in a thing. And my good friend Robin Thorne, who is no relation of mine, he may be on your list, he'd also joined the battalion with me. He lives in Heathfield. He was assistant high commissioner in Aden. He stopped one of these paper bombs and blew off his fingers and so on and so forth. But that was much, much later, of course. But Robin came up to me, he's a very intelligent bloke, Oxford MA and so on and so forth. And he said, "Philip, I must, Cocky's up there," and he says, "They're surrendering." He said, "I must go up and get some loot." I said, "For God's sake, stay with me. They'll only put up a white flag, suddenly lie down on the ground and open up on you." "Oh," he said, "go on, you're windy." I said, "Most certainly I'm windy." Anyhow, he was back in about 5 minutes, and he said, "My God, you were right. They did exactly that. They're a treacherous lot, the Italians. You know, put up a white flag, and as soon as you get up, if you go to take them, you shouldn't let anybody... you shouldn't go to take anybody. You let them come to you, you see. They did exactly that. Anyhow, they didn't catch either my good friend Cocky North, who's also a chap who may be on your list, a jolly good bloke he is as well, or Robin Thorne. And we were told then to take up a position to guard the right flank of the battalion. B Company were to push ahead, as far as I can remember, commanded by a chap who's still alive. I haven't seen him. It's a chap named Dennis O'Callaghan, lives somewhere in Sussex. And we had to go up, further up the hill, to take up a position to guard the right flank of the company. And we pushed a platoon forward, and the company headquarters, which is only about four of us, the company commander, myself as the second in command, and couple of African runners or something, they saw us on this bare hillside and opened up on us. So the company commander said, "What do we do now?" I said, "Well, look, we shall still be carrying out of our orders if we withdraw to those bushes down there, and we take up a position there." So he said, "Yes, that seems to be feasible." And remembering what my father had said about the 1480 war, the Royal Scots never withdrew without an order. And I said, "You have to give a bloody order, because I'm not withdrawing unless you give me an order to do so. And I can pass it up to Wallace, who was the leading platoon commander." He said, "All right, well, we'll withdraw to those trees down there." There was plenty of cover that they couldn't have seen us. So I went forward to get this. I said, "Come on, Wallace, get out. We're withdrawing to those trees." I never saw him again. He ran 3 miles with most of the company, left me with 11 men and a South African engineer. And I thought, well, I don't know what the hell to do now, where he's gone. I didn't know at that time. So I said to the Africans, I said, "No, take up a position here," and so on. And I said, "Anybody moves, I'll shoot you, you see." And they were perfectly all right. They would follow me and so on. And the South African, I said, "My dear chap, you're not under my command. You can do what you like." He said, "I'll stay with you." So I said, "Well, I'm going back to battalion headquarters to tell them what's happened." And I got went down to battalion. I had nobody to send, you see, and nobody knew what had happened. So I thought, I'd go myself. It's a very dangerous thing to do, because it looks as if I might be running, you see. So I went a bit further down, and I bumped into my second lieutenant friend, Major General Manns. Now, forget what I've said about him before, because he was one of the blokes. You know, we said we'd shoot the CO. He's now Major General Manns, Colonel of the Queen's Regiment. And he bumped into me. I said, "What the hell are you doing bumping into me like that?" He said, "Don't be a bloody fool, Thorne." He said, "That was a shell. It's just blown us both over." So I reported to the CO, and he said, "Right." And by that time, the C Company commander, Roger Swinnerton, had been made adjutant. And I knew him quite well, and I said, "Roger, this is what's happened," and so on and so forth. So he said, "Right, get back, stay where you are." And that was that. Well, there was no water, not much ammunition, and no food, except groundnuts. Groundnuts are always a good thing to eat, keep in your pocket and chew them, you see. So I went back, and we were absolutely tired out by that time. And about 6 o'clock in the evening, I got a message on a message form thing that you know of from Roger Swinnerton, who's, as I say, is a great friend of mine, to Second Lieutenant P.A. Thorne, you will take out a patrol and look for your company commander. So I thought, this is it, because they were mined and wired and so on and so forth. At 6 o'clock, it was before 6 o'clock, he said you'll go at 1800 hours. And just before that time, I got a message saying, we have found Captain so-and-so. That message is cancelled, and I was very grateful. But one of the amusing things that happened, I don't know whether you know that morale is always affected by the evacuation of casualties. And we got a message, the RAP had been left down in the hollow, and we were up on the mountain, you see. Well, mountain, ridge.